So, we're going to do some review. Over the summer, I've been having a look at this little Old Testament book of Habakkuk, and we've looked at the first two chapters, and we come to the third chapter, and before I get there, there's going to be some review about what I talked about in the first two chapters. And then I'm going to go way off base. And there's going to be this roundabout way, kind of, you're going to be thinking, where is Joel going with this? But then we'll all bring it around, and hopefully it'll make sense. So, Habakkuk. Habakkuk was upset because of the injustice that was going on around him. He lived just before the exile of Judah to Babylon, and he saw the things that were happening in his homeland with the people there, with the worship, and he looked at the law as well, and it seemed to him that there was a discrepancy. And it says at the beginning of Habakkuk, he says, "Violence, God, violence. What about it? What are you going to do about it? The law is not working. It has no substance because all those things that you said in the law, if you didn't do them," he said back in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, God said, "If you don't do these things, these are the things that are going to happen, all these curses." And he says, "I don't see it. I don't see the justice." So then God answers. And he said, "Be amazed. Be amazed, because you're gonna see something so incredible that you won't believe it. I'm bringing this other nation, and they're gonna be the ones I'm going to use to bring justice to this land. They're the Babylonians, and they're fierce, and they're swift, and they're powerful, and nothing can stand in their way." And Habakkuk says, "Really? Really? That's what you're going to use? You're going to use this other nation that's more wicked than our nation in order to bring justice? That doesn't seem like justice. What do you think Habakkuk was expecting, perhaps?" That seems pure, right? That God would actually himself step out of heaven and say, "Okay, enough's enough. We're going to do some fire and brimstone or something." But the thing was, if you go and look at the law, and you go and look at what God said he was going to do, this is exactly what God said he was going to do. Because you have the blessings for keeping the law, but then you have that much longer section in Deuteronomy, where God says, "I'm going to do this to you if you don't obey, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this. And finally, if you don't worship me," and that was the thing that God could not forgive, right? If you don't worship God, then he says, I will spit you out of this land, because the land itself cannot contain you. The land will need a rest. I'm going to bring another nation to possess you and take you out." That was already foretold. But for Habakkuk, that didn't seem quite right, because maybe he thought that other nation would be more righteous than he was, or his land was. But they weren't. So that seemed, in Habakkuk's mind, he says, "You are too pure, Lord, to have this kind of thing." And then he says, "I'm going to wait. I'm going to watch. I'm going to stand at my watch post, and I'm going to wait and see what the Lord has to say for me. To me." So instead of writing God off completely, even though he's cried out to God, and it seems like he's been crying out for a long time, that's the sense you get at the beginning of Habakkuk, that he's been praying and praying and praying and crying out to God, and there's been no answer. Finally God answers, and then he doesn't like the answer. So instead of writing God off, like we are wont to do, like our culture is wont to do. He says, I'm going to stand and I'm going to wait at my watch post. So he's calling upon one of the most difficult, boring jobs that there were in his time, to stand through the night on the wall and watch. That's what he's going to liken it to. And I'm going to wait for God to see what he has to say. And so God, actually, he does answer, and that's Habakkuk chapter 2. And at the beginning of Habakkuk chapter 2, we have those verses that are cited a few times in the New Testament by Paul. And in the second part of verse 4 of chapter 2, it says, the just shall live by faith. We all know this verse, right? Paul quotes it. The just shall live by faith. But what comes before it actually puts that in context. And you get an understanding of that context when throughout the rest of that chapter, God, through Habakkuk, he pronounces these woes upon the nation that he's going to use to bring justice to his people. And a woe, in biblical language, was a word that you'd only use in extreme feeling of a negative kind. So you would use woe in a funeral when your loved one died. That's the kind of word you would use to describe how you're feeling, right? That utter gut-wrenching despair. You would use woe when your house was destroyed, or your entire neighborhood was destroyed. The people in Palestine and Israel right now could use the word woe because of the fighting and their houses getting smashed to bits. It's that feeling right down there, right? You know, that pit. And you're like, ugh, how can it get any worse? Woe. But when you use woe of a living thing, what does that suggest? And I like the way the New English Translation puts it. It says, those who do this, this is God describing the Babylonians. And he's got a few different things, five different things, how he describes them. And he says, if they do this, they're as good as dead. Woe to them. And if they do this, woe to them, they're as good as dead. And finally, he ends up at the end of chapter 2, and he says, and really, all this is because they have chosen to worship other gods. And thereby, God is saying, even though I'm calling this group over here my people, and they're to be, I am to be their God, he's actually laying claim to the whole earth, is he not? Because he's holding the Babylonians who worship other gods. I don't see him understandably in the biblical context. But he's still saying, you're mine too. You should be worshiping me and me alone. Now, we get into Habakkuk chapter 3. And this is, so God has just sort of finished speaking. And he's given these woes, describing to Habakkuk how it's going to be for the nation that God is using to bring justice to Habakkuk's nation. Now, it's Habakkuk's response. And before we get into that, let's talk about some ancient history. I'm going to guess that shouldn't be surprising to you that before the Bible was actually put down in print, before someone actually put a pen to parchment, there was knowledge of God out there. That seem to make sense to you? Actually, for an awful long time, there was knowledge of God. And that was disseminated and communicated, not by the written word, but orally. People would talk about it. They got a sense of God or the gods. Now, it should also not surprise you, and certain scholarship these days is very intent on pointing out, that there were things written down even before the Bible before any of the biblical writers dip their pen in ink, there were already things written down by other cultures that were adjacent and very close to and in amongst the people of God. That should not be a surprise to you. What's interesting is when you look at these writings and you look at the description that people have of their gods, these other nations, these other peoples who were adjacent to and very close to God's people, the Israelites, when they describe their gods and what they did, and then you look at the Bible, which was written later, there's a lot of similarities. So what certain scholars have taken it upon themselves to do is say, oh, look, well, the Bible's just borrowing and copying what was already there. Is that necessarily the case? Is precedence say that because something was written down before another thing was written down, that must mean that second thing that was written down must have copied the first one? Now, that's going a bit overboard. If we believe our Bible and what we have written down to be the truth, that's good. I mean, that's a good starting point. So what are we to make of these similarities? Well, we all came from one man, according to the book, right? One man and one woman. We all have a common ancestor. So all this knowledge, now Adam and Eve, of course, didn't have a Bible, right? They had nothing written down. In fact, nobody had anything written down until quite a few thousand years later. So what were they to know about God? How was God revealing himself to people? Well, Romans has it right. Paul, through Romans, there's a part of it described there where he says God uses his creation to inform people about himself. But then there's also all those instances that we read about in the Bible where God just shows up, right? He makes himself known. He comes in visions and dreams. He actually sometimes doesn't always use visions and dreams. How about that time when Abraham was sitting under an oak tree and he looked up and he saw three people coming towards him? And it's interesting, that particular passage, because it doesn't seem to describe Abraham as thinking, who could that be? I wonder who's coming. The way it's written is it seems like Abraham knew exactly who those three guys were at a distance, that he knew that they were divine, and one of them was God. So God actually, even before Jesus, was walking around getting his feet dusty. So there was those kinds of things. Now, when we look at some of the other creation accounts, there's similarities there too. This is an image of the Canaanite god, Baal. And most of the legends about Baal and the myths that are written down come from a culture that existed in Canaan sometime before the Israelites got there or came back there. And a lot of that religion was still sort of coasting through when they moved into the land or took it over. And that was from a civilization called Ugarit, and you can look that up. And there's all this Ugaritic poetry, and they had quite the civilization. So, because they were literate, they wrote things down, and they described Baal as sort of this storm god. But Baal was in the high god in this culture. The very highest god in their culture was this deity known as El, which just means God. And he was sort of like the father god. And if you're thinking of other mythologies, if you're into mythology, there's a lot of similarities with that. If you look at the Greek pantheon or the Roman pantheon, there's this high god quite often. Or the Egyptian pantheon, where the high god kind of starts everything rolling and then kind of backs away and then leaves it to his children or to these lesser gods. That was sort of the case in this culture as well, where the high god El left it to his sort of his vice regent, Baal, to do all the running of things. And when you come to a passage in Genesis where Abraham, he's coming back from rescuing his nephew Lot, remember? And who comes out to meet him at Salem? This shadowy individual known as Melchizedek, who was priest of El Elyon. Now, as Western readers, when we read that, we assume, some of us have assumed, that that was somehow Melchizedek was a priest of Yahweh. But it makes much more sense that Melchizedek, living in Canaan and being a Canaanite, was actually a priest of El, who was known in Ugaritic literature as El Elyon, the Most High God. Which underscores the point, doesn't it, in that passage. Here was this priest of another deity showing respect and deference to Abraham's God, Yahweh. So that's sort of that makes it more of the point in that passage, and Hebrews makes a point of that too. Now, Baal is described as a storm god, and he was involved in their creation myth, and he conquered this monster representing the sea called Yam. This is the Babylonian god Marduk. They have a similar story, and there was a high god, and Marduk was a leader of gods, and he became the leader of the gods, much like Zeus became the leader of the Greek mythology, by conquering this sea monster known as Tiamat. Now, what's interesting about these creation stories is that in almost all instances, the creation of these different cultures starts with a turmoil. That there was something there, but it wasn't organized. And quite often, it was embodied as the sea or the ocean. Think about that for a second. As an ancient person, one of the most terrifying things to you would have been the sea, if you'd ever had a chance to experience it. Because we are, by nature, land-bound people, right? We weren't born in the sea. We don't live in the sea. It's extremely difficult to do so. We are land people. So for ancient people, when they stand at the edge of an ocean, and some of us have had experience with this, when all you know is like firm and stable and your food and everything is supplied out of the ground and you look across that immense expanse and there's no end to it and it's just doing this and there's no stability to it, what does that conjure up for you? That's just chaos, isn't it? There's no stability out there. Who'd want to go out there? And some of the earliest sailors were considered heroes for even daring to try. But that's how the creation story start. How does the Bible's creation story start? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Where was the Spirit? He was hovering over the waters. So even our biblical account, even though you've often heard that God created everything out of nothing, right? But the Bible doesn't necessarily follow that up. It says that there was something there. And if for an ancient person, when they read that God, the Spirit of God, was hovering over the waters, well, that just makes sense. Because before there was something, there was chaos. And for the ancient person, and I would suggest for us as well, there's really nothing worse than chaos. Where there's no stability, there's no structure, you don't know what's going to happen next, everything is topsy-turvy. There have been times in your life, in my life, where that has seemed the case, and it's really scary. So that makes a really good creation story, because then you have a divine warrior who comes in, and he conquers something that represents chaos. Where do all the stories of sea monsters come from? They come from these creation myths, because sea monsters, they represent the chaos in the world that this God came to put in order. And in order to put things in order, they had to conquer the monster. They had to conquer the sea. They had to conquer the waters that represented chaos. Now you're all looking at me like, get on with it. Joel, come on. Let us read. This is a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. Now after this, some of your translations might have it. Most don't, but it might be down in the notes. It says, according to Shigeh, I can't even pronounce it. It's a Hebrew word meaning what they guess anyway, best guess, is that Habakkuk is pointing out the meter, that this is a psalm, a song to be sung according to this particular meter, which has led many scholars to suggest that Habakkuk was probably a Levite of some sort, someone who was responsible for coming up with songs for worship for his people, because he seems really familiar with the terminology. Lord, I have heard the report of what you did. I am awed, Lord, by what you accomplished. In our time, repeat those deeds. In our time, repeat those deeds. In our time, reveal them again. Your translations might say, in the midst of the years. But when you cause turmoil, remember to show us mercy. Now, before I go on, one of the other things about ancient deities is about where they live. And that's one of those striking similarities as well. For any ancient person, when they're talking about their God and where their God resides, almost always their God resides or comes from somewhere, and that somewhere is quite often up there. It's from a mountain of some sort. Because people don't go up on mountains. You can't climb mountains. Ancient people didn't mountain climb. Why would you? Why would you go up there? They could see quite well from the valley floor that there's snow up there. They could see quite well that it was going to be bloody well difficult to get up there. Why would you go? That's just dumb. I got to plant stuff. But what did live up there? Something inaccessible. The gods. The God lived up there. Is this sort of making sense to you? If you've done any study of mythology, where did the Greek gods live? On Mount Olympus, right? Almost all these ancient cultures, their gods lived up on a mountain somewhere. And up on a mountain, if you wanted to go and meet that god, you had to kind of go halfway. Which sort of makes sense now of the story of Babel. What were people trying to do? They're trying to create their own mountain. So so that they could get up to where God was. Okay? Where did God meet his people? In the wilderness. Mount Sinai. That's where he gave the law. Now, verse 3, God comes from Timan, the sovereign one from Mount Paran. His splendor covers the skies. His glory fills the earth. He is as bright as lightning. A two-pronged lightning bolt flashes from his hand. What's Marduk holding? That's interesting. This is an outward display of his power. Plague goes before him. Pestilence marches right behind him. What's interesting about this is that in the Ugaritic legends of Baal, Baal often goes out to war with Reshef. You know what the word used for pestilence is here in the Hebrew? Reshef. So Habakkuk is deliberately using terminology that people are familiar with. That's the whole point. Peoples, ancient peoples, they had this idea of what the gods were, what God was. And it was informed by a certain amount of experience of others that had contact with the gods. But a lot of it was legend, it was myth. And yet God seems to have chosen to use that terminology and that imagery to describe himself, okay? He takes his battle position and shakes the earth. With a mere look, he frightens the nations. The ancient mountains disintegrate. The primeval hills are flattened. He travels on the ancient roads. I see the tents of Kushan overwhelmed by trouble. The tent curtains of the land of Midian are shaking. Is the Lord mad at the rivers? Are you angry at the rivers? Are you enraged at the sea? Is this why you climb into your horse-drawn chariots? Your bow is ready for action. You commission your arrows. You cause flash floods on the earth's surface. When the mountains see you, they shake. The torrential downpour sweeps through. The great deep shouts out. It lifts its hands high. Recall the imagery of a creation myth with God conquering chaos represented by the sea. What Habakkuk is calling upon here is God and his power in creation. And quite often you see that throughout the Bible too. When people are praising and worshiping God, particularly in the Psalms, they hearken back to creation. You see a lot of elements of creation. What is more powerful for us to describe our God than his work in creation? For by creation we are all here and exist. It's by creation that we all continue to exist. There's really no greater power than we can call upon to describe God. The sun and moon stand still in their courses. The flash of your arrows drives them away, the bright light of your lightning quick spear. You fiercely stomp on the earth, you angrily trample down the nations. You march out to deliver your people, to deliver your special servant. You strike the leader of the wicked nation. And here's where we're getting down to it. Laying him open from the lower body to the neck. You pierce the heads of his warriors with a spear. They storm forward to scatter us. They shout with joy as if they are plundering the poor with no opposition. But you trample on the sea with your horses on the surging, raging waters. That's really hard for us to appreciate this song, because we don't have that background. But for an ancient person, this description of God, what scholars would call a theophany, just pulls a lot of different elements together. And it was important for Habakkuk to be shown this, to have this in his mind's eye, and then to put it down so that he could describe it to others, obviously. This is the power of Yahweh. This is the power of our God. Yes, these things are described about Baal and Marduk and a lot of others. But Yahweh is the only one who could actually do all that. Recall a little incident with Elijah and 400 prophets of Baal, all of them trying to call down fire to burn a sacrifice. Not one of them brought a match. And they danced around. You remember the story. They danced around and danced around, and they called upon Baal, the god of lightning, mind you, the god of the storm. And it hadn't rained for 3 years. And what did they get? Nothing. They got taunts from Elijah, is what they got. Maybe he's gone to the bathroom. It's in there, read it. And then Elijah prays to Yahweh, but only after dumping several hundred gallons of water on his sacrifice. Who was the storm god? Who was the one that could actually bring lightning and hold lightning bolts like Zeus? Who's the only one that could do that? Yahweh, the God of Israel. And not having rain for 3 years, it's bone dry. And all of a sudden, out of the sky, there is lightning. And it burns up everything, and then it starts to rain. Habakkuk says, so he's described God in this manner. I listened, and my stomach churned. The sound made my lips quiver. My frame went limp, as if my bones were decaying, and I shook as I tried to walk. I long for the day of distress to come upon the people who attack us. What I found interesting about Habakkuk and his attitude was what was lacking there. What would have been, if it was our culture, it would have been different. So what Habakkuk was really upset about, if you look at the first chapter, he was upset about the injustice, right? Injustice was happening. Nothing, there was no balance. So people were doing things bad. They were doing wrong things. And there was no recompense for it. There was no balance. So that's why he said the law is inept. It's not working. And then it's supposed to. That's what it was supposed to do. It was supposed to balance things. And then when God says, okay, this is the balance that I'm providing. Nowhere does Habakkuk say or suggest that justice, that pain shouldn't come. I'm not saying that very well. We live in a culture where pain is equated as being evil, do we not? To suffer discomfort means something is wrong. If we don't have enough money and we can't buy the things that we want or need, something is wrong. If we have health issues and we're in constant pain or we have something that's really annoying even, that's wrong. That shouldn't happen. Right? That's our culture. And that's why the prosperity preachers of any sort are getting so much press, because they're telling you that you're right, that shouldn't happen. Something is wrong. And in order to balance that scale, give me money and I'll show you how that God really wants you to be happy, wealthy, and wise. And we lap it up. Our culture laps that up because that fits in with our notion that pain is bad and pain is evil. Habakkuk does not hold that opinion. Nobody in Habakkuk's culture held that opinion. That would have been dumb to them. They were well accustomed to suffering hardship. That was just life. What they didn't like and what they couldn't stand was that there wasn't any balance. They understood that if they didn't put seed in the ground, they only had themselves to blame if they didn't have a harvest in the fall. You understand? And they understood, especially if they were God's people and they had the law, that if a nation behaved badly and they treated its widows and orphans with disrespect or didn't feed them, that there would be justice done. That's what they couldn't stand. That's what they couldn't grapple with. That's what Habakkuk was grappling with. Justice is not being done, God. So then you hear him say, I long for the day of distress to come upon the people who attack us. Or however it's said in your translation. And God has just given him, in chapter 2, he's just shown him how, yes, even for those people who are seem so much more wicked than your culture and your nation, they've got their thing coming too. Woe to them. So not only is justice being done for Habakkuk's nation, but justice is going to be done upon the people that God is using as well. For Habakkuk, scales are balanced. Now, listen to this. Listen to this. When the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vines, when the olive trees do not produce, and the fields yield no crops, when the sheep disappear from the pen, and there are no cattle in the stalls, what does he just describe for an ancient person? The cupboard is absolutely bare. There's nothing to eat. There's nothing. We are going to starve. I will rejoice because of the Lord. What? What? How can you say that? Our culture would, that's not, how do you wrap your head around that? I will be happy because of the God who delivers me. The sovereign Lord is my source of strength. He gives me the agility of a deer. He enables me to negotiate the rugged terrain. Habakkuk lived in a hard time. There's a lot of people that have hard times. And we tend to empathize with Stephen Fry, if you remember that video a few weeks ago, where we shake our finger at God and we say, how dare you? How dare you? There's no end to this. Or it seems like there's no end to it. And you can read about people like the boys in Sudan. When that war was still going on. But they're being kidnapped to serve in an army. And they're the boys that got ran away. They lost everything. They had nothing. And they're just running. And where the oldest boy in a group would be, like, what, 17? And he was, like, supposed to be a father figure for all these other little boys. And they said, we thought God forgot about us. Can you imagine? And Habakkuk, that's what he said at the beginning of the book, basically, have you forgotten? What about us? We often think of God when we're going through these troubles as the guy in the boat, right? There we are drowning. And he's that guy in the boat that's like, hold on. I'm going to be there. Just hold on for a minute. It's going to be a little while. You just have to hold on. That's how we imagine God. He's not. You know what God is? He's the life jacket you've got on. He's your life jacket. He's with you in the water. And yeah, it's cold. And the waves are high. And you can't even see that boat. But he's got you. He gives me the agility of a deer. He enables me to negotiate the rugged terrain. That's what following Yahweh is like. That's what true faith is. It's not shunning pain. It's not thinking that discomfort is some sort of evil and that God's going to help you just remove that. That's some people's God. That's what they really want. They just want God to remove all impediment from their lives so that they can just have it easy. That's what we all want, really, right? But God doesn't work that way. God is the one who gets down into the mud and into the water with you and says, you can do this. He doesn't remove obstacles. He gives you the ability to overcome them. That's the difference. And Habakkuk further he broadcasts his musical professionalism by saying, this prayer is for the song leader. It is to be accompanied by stringed instruments. It's a short book. And you get the sense that Habakkuk, the time frame was probably quite long. Habakkuk saw a lot. But at the end, it kind of goes back to this, right? I'll stand and I'll keep watching. Don't write God off. Don't write him off. In the storms of life, that chaos, when chaos comes, remember who created and overcame chaos right at the beginning. God did, and he continues to do that. And that's why you can read those Psalms that talk about God overcoming chaos, and you apply it to yourself. You can continue to apply it to yourself. There's chaos in my life right now, but God, he's the divine warrior. He conquers that, and he does it quite handily, too. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this time in your word this morning. We thank you for speaking to Habakkuk. We thank you for the concerns Habakkuk had. We're thankful that you didn't write him off and give him a waggy finger and told him to behave. Thank you that you engaged with him and gave him words that at first seemed confusing and not right, but it eventually encouraged him and allowed him to see you as you really are and how you want to be in our lives. Lord, I just pray that these words would find meaning in our own lives. And as we continue to read other portions of your word, that things would just sort of snick into place, as we realize that, yeah, our God is able. These things we pray in Jesus' name.